Before we do the litany for the sanctuary garden, this is a good time to introduce the Reverend Mark Sabbath, who will be preaching here today. For those of you who may be new and don't know him, Mark Sabbath received his Master of Divinity from the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley. For 26 years, he worked as a business leader and executive director of social service, educational, and environmental nonprofit organizations in Austin and Santa Fe. He has practiced and taught meditation and yoga for more than three decades. Mark is a former member of this church, known for his activity in the listening ministry, the choir, lay leading and lay sermons, the stewardship committee, and the men's breakfast. I hope I haven't left out anything. His most recent remarkable achievement is becoming ordained as a UU minister. He is currently the minister of the UU Church of the Hill Country in Kerrville. And now, an introduction to the litany. In honor of Earth Day, we wish to celebrate a little part of our planet by bringing attention to our sanctuary garden. Its renovation has become quite a project. Some people contributed money, some contributed equipment and supplies, while others gave of their mind and muscle. All are to be acknowledged, whether named or unnamed. The project included removing a lot of old materials and plants, putting in new electrical, plumbing, drainage, dirt, rocks, plants, vases, and lots of other stuff. Phase one was taken on by Michael Mathis in the support of the Sadegh Mathis family. It served as a project for achieving his Eagle Scout rank. It consisted of the demolition of the old fountain, removing a raised bed, extending the rock path, relocating plants that would be used later, as well as general cleanup. This work was completed last June during what became one of Austin's hottest summers. Since then, Paige Hill, Elizabeth Gray, John Payne, and Lynn Adams took up the work. John Payne worked many hours on the sprinkler system. Lynn incorporated many remembrances of her mother, an avid gardener, into this sacred space. Please gaze into the garden space to enjoy and exchange the energies of life. And let us join together to recite a litany composed by Reverend Mark for this occasion. When you hear me say, "Together we give thanks and say," then you respond, "We join with the earth and with each other." To the covenant of creativity and sustainability of the people who built this space, they showed up, gave of themselves, and benefited from the fellowship. They walked the talk of creating a church community in fellowship. Together we give thanks and say, we join with the earth and with each other. For the entire design, the sustainable native Texas plants, the wildlife habitat, the conservation of water and maintenance, protection of our drainage systems and delicate stucco, together we give thanks and say, we join with the earth and with each other. For the beauty and functionality of raised beds and fountains, more visible and enjoyable, together we give thanks and say, we join with the earth and with each other. For our sanctuary garden, a work in process, time and Mother Nature will decide which plant will last and where we will be given opportunities to do new things. Together we give thanks and say,
we join with the earth and with each other. Let us bless our sanctuary garden. Where it was mostly dead and neglected, it is now reborn. Out of apparent ruin, Something of beauty and renewal has been created by the efforts of the people of this church. This garden embodies the cycles of life, the cycles of life of this church and of our own lives. In our sanctuary garden, may we be reminded that we Unitarian Universalists are people of self and world creation. May we be reminded that every day both life and death are set before us. Let us have the trust and the courage to choose those involvements that can lead us toward life more abundant. And may we have the will to serve those life-giving involvements with our whole self in covenant, in community. Together we give thanks and say, we bless this earth and each other. Amen.
A reading by Barbara J. Piskine. For the beauty of the earth, this spinning blue-green ball. Yes, Gaia, mother of everything, we walk gently across your back to come together again in this place to remember how we can live, to remember who we are, to create how we will be. Gaia, our home, the lap in which we live, welcome us.
What a beautiful experience to be with you again. I'm grateful for the opportunity. One morning, a long, long time ago, about 120 million years to be exact, something incredible happened here on this earth. The first flower ever to appear on our planet opened up to receive the rays of the sun. Prior to this momentous event, the planet had been covered in vegetation for millions of years, but none had ever before flowered. I imagine the first flower probably didn't last very long, since conditions were not quite favorable for a widespread flowering to occur. One day, however, such conditions came about, and a critical threshold was reached, and our planet became filled with an explosion of color and aroma. It was an evolutionary transformation in our lives and, of course, the life of our planet. Well, much later, flowers would come to play an essential part in the evolution of another species, us, Homo sapiens. Think about it. Over the years, flowers have provided inspiration and insight to countless artists, poets, teachers, mystics. In the New Testament, for example, Jesus himself tells us to contemplate the flowers and to learn from them how to live. And the Buddha is said to have given a silent sermon in which he held a flower and simply gazed at it. After a while, one monk began to smile. It is said this monk was the only one who got the sermon. And of course, getting it means that he got awakened. Bodhi, awakenedness. According to that legend, that smile was handed down by 28 consecutive masters and later became the origin of Zen. So it's no accident that flowers are included in so much Buddhist art. Seeing the beauty in a flower can awaken humans, however briefly, to the beauty of an essential part of our own innermost being, as the Buddha called it, our original face, our true nature. This is one of the reasons that many of us enjoy gardening and to work with plants. They are serene, and their energy is infectious. This is all described by Eckhart Tolle in what I guess is still his latest book, A New Earth. Tolle raises the possibility that important religious teachers like the Buddha and Jesus were of some of humanity's early flowers, so to speak. That's to say that as our precursors, they were rare and precious beings who were revolutionary in their day. As the first flower was 120 million years ago. And when they appeared on Earth, conditions were not yet favorable for a widespread comprehension of their messages. This, argues Tolle, is because humanity wasn't evolved enough, hadn't yet reached a critical threshold of understanding to grasp their teachings. Thus, these great teachers were largely misunderstood by their peers. So this raises the question, are we any more evolved now, 2,000, 2,500 years later, since the Buddha and Jesus were alive? How many of us think that we are? Although this evolutionary growth of consciousness has seemed to come in fits and spurts, it even seems to regress at times, doesn't it? In these days of population growth, and climate change, of industrialization and shrinking natural habitats, the question becomes whether or not we are evolving quickly enough to preserve life as we know it. And I want to be clear, this is not a doomsday Earth Day message. Rather, I want to share with you this morning why it is that I am hopeful in spite of the many problems threatening the health and future of our Mother Earth. Let me start with the assertion that we already possess the technical knowledge, the communication tools, the ability to educate our fellow humans about population control, and we have the material resources to grow enough food, ensure clean air and water, and meet the rational energy needs of all of us. We have everything we need to survive and even thrive for generations to come. Everything that is, except the required shift of consciousness that will inspire us to implement these changes on a global scale. Many of us are still plagued by old habits and understandings that have caused the mess that we now find ourselves in. Quote, "The cosmos is all that is and all there ever will be," unquote. Thus began the famous astronomer Carl Sagan's majestic 1980 television series. The epic grandeur of Sagan's cosmos, suffused with billions and billions of planets, stars, and galaxies, captivated the imagination of viewers everywhere. But despite the almost sacred reverence for existence that permeated the series, some still took issue with its strictly scientific basis, finding little room for the numinous or the transcendent in Sagan's naturalistic worldview. 15 years later, the integral philosopher Ken Wilber issued an 800-page response with such concerns as these in his book titled Sex, now that I have your attention, Ecology and Spirituality. Now, this grand tome argued for a more holistic conception of the universe, one that would honor the profound revelations of science and religion alike. He called the universe the cosmos, with a K for the Greek. So when some use the term cosmos with a K, it's not only to affirm our appreciation for Sagan's extraordinary universe, but also to restore some spiritual depth and perhaps transcendent mysticism that the ancient Greek philosophers who coined the word duly acknowledged and revered. Perhaps a little more realistic synthesis of the two comes from the renowned systems thinker Gregory Bateson. He writes, "If you put God outside and set God vis-a-vis the creation, and if you have the idea that you are created in this image, You will logically and naturally see yourself as outside and against the things around you. Now he says, as you arrogate all mind to yourself, from the Latin arrogatus, same root as arrogant, to seize or claim without justification. As you arrogate all mind to yourself, you will see the world around you as mindless and therefore not entitled to moral or ethical consideration. The environment will be seen as yours to exploit. Your survival unit will be you and your folks or conspecifics against the environment composed of other social units, other races, and the brutes and the vegetables. If this is your estimate of your relation to nature, and you have advanced technology, your likelihood of survival will be that of a snowball in hell. Yes, quoted by Gregory Bateson. You will die either by the toxic byproducts of your own hate or simply of overpopulation and overgrazing. Check out Greg Bateson sometime. Sounds daunting and all too familiar. So where's the good news? Although still relatively small, there's a rapidly growing percentage of humanity that is experiencing a shift in consciousness that many deem necessary if we're going to survive as a human species. Some associate this shift to the theories and proofs of quantum physics. Others attribute it to the emergence of the internet, which has brought connections and ideas into our homes from all over the world, our global village. And still others see it as the natural result of the end of imperialism, or the 2,500-year epoch of the Dark Ages. I personally think that all these things are having some impact, and more. You just go to any bookstore, and you're likely to find a number of books on the subject, some written by notable scholars, such as Joanna Macy and David Corton. These two writers differ greatly in their fields of expertise. Macy is a Buddhist scholar. Corton is a business and economics expert. But both are currently telling us the same thing, that we are living in a defining moment in the course of our history, that the era of cheap oil is ending, climate change is undeniably real, that economies can no longer rest on unsustainable foundations of financial and environmental debt. Out of necessity, they tell us, we are collectively entering this new era. We are moving away from a life-killing political economy birthed by the Industrial Revolution, and we're moving toward a sustainable, life-enhancing political economy that exists more in harmony with the Earth. They both refer to what's happening now by the same name. They call it the Great Turning. Perhaps you've heard of it. Simply put, this concept of the Great Turning encompasses all the actions currently being taken to honor, care for, and preserve life on Earth these days. And there are lots of them. It involves a new understanding of who we are and what we need to be happy. In large numbers, people are turning from the falsehood of the old paradigm that there is an isolated, competitive, solid self. In its stead, we're beginning to embrace a new paradigm in which our selfish and solid separateness is seen for what it really is, an illusion. We are discovering our interconnectedness to everything, our mutual belonging to the web of life. So despite centuries of mechanistic Newtonian conditioning, we are slowly learning to name, once again, this world and everything in it as sacred, as whole. Now, whether these theories and understandings come through Gaia theory, systems theory, chaos theory, or through liberation theology, shamanic practices, or the evolutionary theology of UCC Minister Michael Dowd, or engaged Buddhism, or even Unitarian Universalism, Such insights and experiences are now freeing growing numbers of us from the grip of the industrial corporate growth society. They are offering us nobler goals and deeper pleasures. They are redefining our wealth and our worth, thus liberating us, finally, from the compulsions to consume and to control everything in sight. To me, I view this trend as a natural emergence of the feminine, or yin, principle in a world that has been strongly skewed toward the masculine, or yang, principle. But that's me. However you view it, there's no denying the fact that something is sparking transition around the world, and that's giving me hope. That's because one of the best aspects of this shift is there's less room now for panic or self-pity. How in the world can he say that, you say? No, with these new understandings of who we really are, it's gratitude that generally arises rather than fear. We become grateful to be alive at this moment when, for all the darkness around us, blessings and awakenings abound. The great turning helps us to stay mindful and steady, helping us to hold hands in community and find a way that we and the world can self-heal. The present chaos, then, doesn't doom us, but becomes a seedbed for a better, more sacredly connected future. And this becomes a very exciting time to be alive. We have so much potential. We can make such a difference. Of course, that's not to say that these coming years will be easy. One can always expect resistance to change, especially when it affects profitability and patterns of dominance. No, we are now encountering great times of suffering and uncertainty, and at times our grief will seem overwhelming, like the type of grief that so many are currently feeling about the wars, the genocides, the natural disasters, the overpopulation, the species extinction, and so many more disasters. But like living cells of a larger body, it's natural that we feel the trauma of our world. So today, as we approach the official Earth Day, I say today we'll celebrate Earth Day, we offer some balance to the paralysis of analysis and its intense anguish that we might be feeling these days. Now, these responses arise from the depth of our caring and the truth of our interconnectedness with all beings. After all, to suffer with is the literal meaning of compassion. And this world could use a lot more compassion. So what if we were to understand our relation to nature and to our environment in sacred terms, or poetic terms, or with Emerson and Thoreau in good old American transcendentalist terms? But there is no broadly shared language with which to do this. So we're forced to resort to what, in fact, is a lower common denominator, the languages of science and of bureaucracy. These languages have broad legitimacy in our culture, a legitimacy that possesses its strength largely because of the thoroughness with which they have discredited religious discourse in the 18th and 19th centuries. But many babies went out with the bathwater of religious dogma and superstition. And one of these was morality. Even now, science can't say we ought not to harm the environment, except to say that we shouldn't be self-destructive. And another one of these lost children was our very relation as human beings with the mystery of existence as such. As the philosopher Leibniz famously wondered, why is there something rather than nothing? For St. Thomas Aquinas, one of my mentors from the 13th century, this was the fundamental religious question. Why is there something rather than nothing? And in the place of a medieval and Renaissance relation to the world that was founded on this mystery, we have a mechanical relation that is objective and data-driven. We no longer have a forest. We have bored feet. We no longer have a landscape, a world that is our own. We have valuable natural resources. Avowed Christians have been slow to recall this sacred relationship with the world. For example, only recently have American evangelicals begun thinking of the environment in terms of what they call creation care. We don't have to be born again to agree with evangelicals that one of the most powerful arguments missing from our 21st century environmentalist case is reverence for what simply is. One of the heroes of Goethe's Faust was a character called Care, Sorge, who showed Faust the unscrupulousness of his actions and led him to salvation, salvation by care. Environmentalism may have made a Faustian pact with quantitative reasoning, and science has given it power, but it cannot provide deliverance, folks. If environmentalism truly wishes, as it claims, to want to save something, the planet, the species, itself, it needs to recover and rediscover the common language of care. So here's a valuable learning. You cannot defeat something that you imagine to be an external threat to you when in fact it is actually internal to you. When what you are resisting is your own life. Truth is, these so-called external threats are a great convenience to our culture. It's convenient that we can imagine a power beyond us because that means we don't have to spend much time examining our own lives. And it's convenient that we can hand the hard work of our resistance to these so-called externals over to scientists, our designated national problem solvers. Environmentalism should stop depending solely on its alliance with science for its sense of itself. It should look to create a common language of care, a reverence for, a commitment to the astonishing fact of flowers and plants and each other and our existence, through which it could begin to create alternative principles by which we might live. As Leo Tolstoy wrote in his famous essay, My Religion, faith is not about obedience to church dogma. It's not about submission to an established authority. He wrote, a people's religion are the principles by which they live. I'll close with this. The establishment of these principles by which we might live could begin with three questions. First, what does it mean to be a human being? Second, what is my relation to other human beings? And third, what is my relation to existence as such, the ongoing miracle that there is something rather than nothing? If the answer to these questions is that the purpose of being human is for the pursuit of happiness, understood as success, which may also be understood as acquisition of money and things, if our relation to others is a relation to mere things with nothing to offer but what they can do for us, and if our relation to the world is only to resources that we should exploit for profit, then we should be very comfortable with the world we have. If this world goes to perdition, at least we can say that we acted in good faith. But if, on the other hand, we answer there should be a greater sense of self-worth in being human, more justice in our relation with others, more reverence for existence as a sacred whole, then we must either live in bad faith with the market-driven capitalism and other systemic givens, or begin describing a future whose fundamental values and on whose daily activities are so radically different from what we currently endure. The risk I propose is for us to rise to the nobility of a star. We should refuse to be mere functions of a system that we cannot in good conscience defend, and we should insist on living a new story, one that recognizes the mystery, the miracle, and the dignity of things. From flowers to frogs to forests to our fellow humans. Simply because they are. Happy Earth Day.